Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, we Zoomed the day before, so if Donald Trump pulls something out of his hat on Thursday night, we will not be discussing it till Rethink the Week on Monday. As you've come to expect, we've been doing this for months. We'll continue to do it through the election of November 2020, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. It's the voice of a patriot. Have that voice in your head as you exercise the franchise this November. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quam Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And Scott has been the best teacher I could possibly imagine. If I ever want to know anything about Texas, Texas history, Texas politics, geography, Texas food even, mm-hmm. I would turn to Scott Braddock.
Yeah.
But I hate to say this, Scott, you also had some competition.
Oh, well, there's lots of it here. It's a big state. It's a big state, Arnie. Nobody can do it all.
I had a listener, and I say had because I just found out this morning that he died, who would email me almost religiously all the time.
Yeah.
And Jim Sherman was a remarkable man with a very, very interesting and eclectic background. I'm going to take a point of personal privilege and share with my audience what I posted on my Facebook page. My show airs on the Pacifica Network, but at 5 a.m. in Houston on KPFT, you can hear me daily. I just lost a listener who became a friend. He woke up with me and shared his life with me. Radio is unlike any other medium. It creates an intimacy and relationship that TV and newspapers and Facebook can't touch. I will miss you, Jim Sherman. Thank you for sharing your life with me. And Houston, you have lost a prince. Au revoir, Jim Sherman.
Beautiful words, and you said it just right. You know, a friend of mine was asking about radio stuff the other day. Earlier in the week, I was the guest host on the Mark Davis Show in Dallas-Fort Worth, and Mark Davis is a big conservative host. You've probably heard of him. He's kind of legendary from Texas. Used to be one of the fill-in hosts for Rush Limbaugh and all of that. Main thing for me when I'm doing a show like that is doing radio.
Right.
You know, having the Trump act with their most valuable commodity, which is their audience, right? And when you're the fill-in for a radio host, it's kind of like they gave you the keys to their house for the weekend and said, here, don't mess anything up. So you're still yourself, and you watch the TV shows that you would watch instead of what they would watch and talk about the things that you would talk about instead of what they would talk about, but you're not going to eat all the snacks in the refrigerator, and you're not going to break things before they get back, and you've been entrusted. And the thing about that relationship with the audience is it is very intimate, and if you're doing the show correctly, if you're doing it right, then the person at home feels that you're just listening, you are listening to each other, that you're talking to them, they're talking to you, they can reach out to you. They can do that through email or social media or whatever else. And you do create very real relationships with people who, in some cases, you've never actually met in person. And that's okay, because actually, during this time when so many people are isolated, it's that much more important to have these very real relationships over the airwaves. So I'm sorry that you lost your friend.
Well, and again, because I air so early in the morning, it's, you know, shift change. It's right around getting time to maybe wake up and make breakfast. And I'm going to share with my audience, I actually get a lot of letters from people that are in the state penitentiary. I also get people who are listening on the air and they're locked up. And that's fascinating too, because I feel like I've created relationships in places I would never go, mm-hmm. but yet people who actually want a sense of belonging and part of society and they want to learn and engage. That's, again, the power of radio. It creates something that I, honest to God, I've done TV, I've written for the Boston Globe, mm-hmm. I've done lots of different things.
Not the same.
I wouldn't change radio for anything in the world.
Anyway, the same.
On that note, lots going on in Texas. Obviously, the election is one of the most crucial things because everyone's fighting about, you know, how often you can vote, according to Donald Trump, apparently a couple of times he suggested in North Carolina. And then, of course, how you vote, mail-in voting, do you walk in, do you have early voting? So what's going on with the election and the vote in Texas?
Well, Harris County, which is home to one-fifth of the Texas electorate, you're talking about Houston. Harris County is the county, and it's home to about 2 million Texas voters. And right now there's this big fight that's going on in multiple courtrooms, by the way, over the course of the last week at the Texas Supreme Court and in federal court. They've been trying to figure out what's going to happen with this mail-in ballot situation. So many people across the great state do not feel comfortable going to the polls this fall, which, of course, is coming up pretty quick now. That's, you know, in-person early voting is getting underway in just about a month or so here. So we're coming up on the election. It's all coming together real fast now, Arnie. We kept hearing about this election that was coming at some point, and now it's really all happening. You know, at some point, Democrats have to run in the same election as everybody else, right? I mean, after the avenues run out, they've got to try to get people to the polls in person if that's the way that they're going to have to vote. But there have been some interesting legal maneuvers on this. The Attorney General of Texas, of course, Ken Paxton, our indicted Attorney General, suing the county clerk in Houston, a guy named Chris Hollins. And Hollins had gone on and done something that I think was unprecedented in state history. During the pandemic, he said that his office, which is, you know, responsible for getting people ready to vote, they were going to, unsolicited, go ahead and send out applications to all eligible voters in Harris County. So we're talking about, you know, roughly 2 million people who would be getting this. And it's not a ballot. It's the form to request a mail ballot. How many hoops can we get people to jump through, Arnie? You have to mail in the form to get a ballot in the mail to mail that back, right? So you'd have to do a lot, you know, if you're somebody who wants to vote this way, rather than just go down to the polling place on election day. But a lot of people don't feel comfortable doing that, especially people who are in vulnerable populations or people who are, you know, in the presence of people who are in, you know, in the vulnerable population frequently. And the legalities of this, fascinating. So in Texas, if you're 65 or older, you can vote by mail and you don't have to state any sort of a reason. You just ask for a mail ballot, they'll send you one, and you're good to go. But the law also provides for people who are disabled to be able to do the same thing. But being disabled under the statute is kind of loosely defined. Democrats in this case are arguing, and they argued at the, you know, at the court in Austin. Also, they were at the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans this week arguing you know, on this point, that people who do not, and this is not a case of people being afraid, that's what you hear in the media a lot. If people fear that they might get COVID-19, then they should be able to vote by mail instead of having to go down to the polling place. But it's not the fear. The statute doesn't provide for you to be afraid to go to the polling place. Because believe me, there are places in Texas you might be afraid to go to the polling place for lots of reasons, you know, that you might be victim of a drive-by shooting or something. But look, it's not the fear. It's the fact that you don't have an immunity to a disease that is ravaging the world. Democrats are arguing that that lack of immunity to this disease, to the pandemic, that constitutes a disability under the law. So you should be, that's a physical condition that right. you don't have, you know, any built up immunity to this thing. And we don't know that much about immunity to COVID-19 at this point, as you know. They're arguing that. But the Supreme Court Chief Justice in Texas had some very interesting comments about this. And I wanted to read you his quote because it's important.
One quick point, and that is that argument that the Democrats are making in Texas is the argument that the Republican governor in New Hampshire has made allowing for absentee balloting. He would not have, you know, absentee balloting for no reason, but if you have an absentee balloting because of the concerns relating to contracting COVID, because there is no immunity, uh-huh. is what the Republican governor in New Hampshire argued, so that's why we can actually apply for absentee balloting. So just to let you know, it's sort of bipartisan in the argument, depending on what state you land in.
Right, and the question of disability for getting a mail ballot is really left up unto the individual in Texas. It's up to the person who is the voter. And I'm not saying that. The Republican Chief Justice,
wow,
the Texas Supreme Court, in an interview, made the following comments. He said that it's really left up to the individual. Here is the quote. "The statute leaves this decision up to the voter. You can't ask the voter about it. There is no form they have to fill out. They don't have to swear to it. Don't have to sign anything. All they have to do is say, I want a mail-in ballot because, in my view, I need one." That's the law in Texas today. And so you have the Attorney General, and again, that's the Republican Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Chief Justice, by the way, is placed in the Chief Justice position by the governor of the state after the justices are elected statewide. That's not just the law. It's also the position of the court. It has found that in previous cases dealing with this issue, not on COVID-19 specifically, but when it came to disabilities for people. This is high stakes in a way that's hard to describe, Arnie. I mean, let's think about the way that the polling has looked in Texas. Let's connect the dots for people. The polling in Texas indicates what? And President Trump has sounded kind of concerned about this. He talked about it at the RNC when he said that, look, if you don't believe in God and you're against guns and you're against the oil and gas industry, you don't have a shot in Texas. He's feeling he has to make an argument about why Democrats can't win statewide in Texas. But the polling shows that Biden is either neck and neck with Trump, and we've actually seen a couple of polls that show that Biden is ahead of Trump in Texas by 1 point. Now, I don't necessarily believe that. Early vote's coming up, but we're still a little far out from the campaign here, and we don't know exactly what all is going to be done by the campaigns as they start to spend that money. We saw that
there might be a vaccine by then. Who knows?
It might be a vaccine. We have no clue where any of this is headed. There are a lot of external factors that are going to influence this deal. But with the polling looking like that, this fight in Houston could not be more important, not just for Texas, but for the country. If Biden and Trump are really only separated by 1 or 2 points in Texas, if Republicans wanted to contest the election results come November 4th, or after all of the mail ballots are counted, a week after, we've heard, right, that it could take up to 10 days or something like that for all the mail ballots to be counted in the various states. Let's say Biden does win Texas by 1 point. That's 38 electoral votes. Do you think there's a path to the presidency for a Republican if Texas flips Democratic? Now, I'm not predicting that, but all the way this is lining up makes me believe that Republicans are kind of creating an insurance policy. So if you have legal challenges and courts that find that it was not legal for the Harris County clerk to have sent these ballot request forms to 2 million people in the Houston area, then you probably have enough votes set up and sort of in the queue to try to be invalidated after the election has played out after November 3rd, which could mean the Republicans are setting up this legal framework to be able to do that. I think it's definitely worth watching, and it probably has more national ramifications than people are thinking about right now.
So I've been reading a lot about the potential for lawsuits, and they said plan on like maybe hundreds of Bush v. Gore, basically sort of illegal challenges all over the
all
country.
All over.
Whether Everywhere. They're at the yeah. state level, mm-hmm. whether at the county level, they're going to be micro and major, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see. But again, I want to remind everyone that the argument that's being argued by the Democrats against your indicted attorney general is exactly the argument that my Republican governor has been using to basically expand the concept of absentee balloting. But this is where hypocrisy really reigns. Because you're not only... Yeah, it does. It does.
Okay.
I love this.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. Meantime, the Texas GOP is sending mail ballot applications to Texans who haven't requested them. Oh my God, I'm putting my finger down my throat. Gag me like a spoon. Like,
yes.
Excuse me. So on one way, they're saying, this is bad, bad, bad. Don't do this, Harris County clerk. And then they're saying, oh, but for us, not a problem.
Yes. Chris Hollins, who I mentioned, who is the county clerk in Harris County, he tweeted this out, I believe yesterday. He said, heads up, Texas GOP, someone is masquerading as you and sending mail ballot applications to thousands, perhaps millions of Texans who haven't requested them. I know that you're opposed to mail ballots, so this can't possibly be you. Find these people and stop them. He has pictures here of this mail piece that went out from the Republican Party of Texas, the actual official apparatus of the GOP in this state. It's got President Trump's picture with, fist in the air, Trump victory. This is the land of greatness and all of that. And enclosed in the mailer, it has the form for people to fill out and send back if they want a mail ballot. So they're trying to make sure that as many people who are eligible to vote by mail who are Republicans will take advantage of that. This is going to, I can imagine that this mailing would be going to people who are, in Texas, we don't register people as, you know, one party or the other, but you can look at primary history and you could say, okay, somebody who's voted in two or three or four Republican primaries in Texas is probably getting this mailer. And they're probably not being, and you know, when you look at the mailer, the mail piece that went out, it's not really being fully explained who would be excluded from being able to vote by mail. So they're already doing one version of the sift and the sword here by sending this only to known Republican voters to be able to get their mail ballots in. Because we have seen polling, Arnie, that has indicated that people who are older folks, people who are in the vulnerable population, 65 and up, people who tend to vote Republican, are nervous about going to the polling place. You know, I've seen this all over the state and traveling just the last couple of weeks. Business travel, by the way, Arnie, is a little like that movie where Tom Hanks is stuck in the airport by himself. You're in all these hotels. There's nobody around. And there is nobody around because nobody wants to be, you know, catching this disease, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. And so the way that people talk about this versus what they actually do in their real lives is very different. You know, you hear all of this sort of bluster from people, this bantam rooster BS where they, you know, well, if I get the disease, you know, I'll beat it. You know, don't worry about that. That's what you see people echoing what they hear on Fox News Channel. But at the same time, they may be wearing a mask. They may be walking around with, you know, a bottle of Lysol everywhere they go. Well, two things can be happening at once, of course, which is that, you know, people on the one hand don't want anybody telling them what to do. That's traditional Texas politics. You can't tell me what to do. You know, it's freedom and liberty and all of that. But at the same time, they can be very nervous about catching a disease that could kill them or a loved one.
Okay, so let me just say something else. So I've been sort of doing this sort of bifurcated conversation. That's what they're saying in Texas. This is what they're saying in New Hampshire. So the Republican Party in New Hampshire did something very interesting. Unlike your Republican Party that's sending out these applications for absentee balloting, in New Hampshire, the Republican Party sent out absentee ballots, but they went to an unknown address. So they could be returned, mm-hmm. but they would be returned to an address that doesn't exist. And interestingly enough, we don't think it was actually sent to Republicans. We think it was sent to other people that weren't Republicans.
Of course.
So you get this invitation for an absentee ballot, and then you find out that all the absentee ballots are going to P.O. Box 900 in Durham. Well, yep. We don't all live in Durham. They're supposed to go back to your individual community. There is no P.O. Box. So I just want people to know there are so many games being played. Mm-hmm. The level of hypocrisy. I mean, we need a split screen for every single thing that happens because on the one hand and on the other hand, but on the one hand and on the other hand, there is no consistency here. All they're doing is basically, I think, adding again to the chaos around this election. Mm-hmm. Who do you trust? We don't know who to trust with COVID-19. Now we don't know who to trust when it comes to how to vote.
Well, we do know one entity that is very trusted in Texas that has now weighed in on this. So let me bring this up. The head of this company is reticent usually to insert himself into politics, but you won't find many brands in Texas other than maybe Whataburger that are more beloved than the HEB grocery store. HEB is something that's known to people even outside of Texas. It's a very large company. And the head of the company, Charles Butt, the chairman, his family has run a company forever. It's a privately held company. And he wrote a letter to the justice of the Texas Supreme Court, the chief justice, and said that what needed to happen is as many people who can get mail ballots as possible need to get them. People who only feel comfortable voting that way need to be able to vote that way. I'm paraphrasing, but let me read a little bit of the letter to you. And, you know, I did see where some people were saying that, well, everybody's going to the grocery store in person. And so if they can go to the grocery store in person, they should be able to vote in person. That would omit the fact that HEB has been extremely innovative in trying to figure out how to get people their groceries without them having to be around people. They have developed many different programs, not unlike Amazon, where they would deliver the groceries or people could pick them up curbside and not actually have to go into the store. I know that you saw, Arnie, the story in Texas Monthly earlier this year where HEB was watching what was happening in China as all of this was starting to play out. And they were already gaming out how they were going to keep their supply chain going so that people would have everything that they needed. And one of the things that they talked about in the story was that the only thing that they got wrong that they didn't foresee was that there would be this run on toilet paper, that everybody would buy up toilet paper because that's nothing to do with the disease. It made no sense that everybody was stockpiling toilet paper. But anyway, the head of HEB, Charles Butt, did write to the Texas Supreme Court and say that based on our experience at HEB, many people, including those of all ages, are nervous about contracting the virus by extension, in my opinion. Many would be anxious about voting in person. Clerk Collins, who I mentioned, the county clerk in Houston, has reasonably given these voters a chance to guard against perilous exposure in a manner consistent with this court's opinion and election code. So he's the Texas election code. So he's also citing what the Chief Justice had said earlier that I told you about, where the Chief Justice had said in Texas, it's up to the individual. They don't, you know, go and interrogate you at your house if you ask for a mail ballot. That's not going to happen. And I will tell you that there are plenty of Republicans who will acknowledge privately that there's not the time nor the resources to go around a state of 254 counties and nearly 30 million people across two time zones and try to ask everybody who requested a mail ballot and try to figure out whether they, quote unquote, should have been able to get that mail ballot. This is all about, as we suggested earlier, this is all about creating a legal framework to potentially challenge election results later if need be, in places especially like Dallas County and Harris County, et cetera. I will also tell you that the head of HEB said, in just as many words, that democracy works the best when as many people are able to participate as possible.
I sent you a note and you said no. I sent you a note and I said, why can't he become the president of the United States?
he's got the money to run if he wanted to.
By the way, that
company, I want to underscore this, they so rarely inject themselves into politics. The only thing that HEB really consistently pushes as far as public policy is a strong public education system in Texas. They do help to fund a group called Raise Your Hand Texas, so they're very well known for that. As far as any of these, you know, really controversial things like this, which who knew that the post office would be the big controversy of the year? I don't know if you had that on your bingo card for 2020, Arnie, but suddenly this has become the lightning rod issue, and they're stepping right into the middle of it. You won't find a more respected company, and not just by people who are their customers, but also by people who are their employees. Right. You know, this is a company that takes care of their workers. This is the people who go to work at HEB often, I've seen this many times, many of my friends, they go to work at HEB as, you know, sackers of trees, working their first job after high school in the afternoon. And, you know, when they're 40, when they're my age, they're a manager over there. And so they just stay with the company, you know, yeah. And they, even though it's privately held, they give the employees the ability to buy shares in the company and get their retirement plan going and everything like that. And
so
you couldn't find a better group of people to be weighing in on it.
So let me just say why I said, could he run for president? The reason I said that is, you know, Republicans always talk about, you know, let's treat government like a business. Well, I would like to treat government like his business, because he looked at China and he learned from the China experience, because he believes that people should be protected, because he understands the idea of providing education, because he doesn't just look at his business as if it's in isolation. He looks at how it impacts his community and his state. And as a result, he not only takes care of his employees, he's taking care of us. That's what he's doing. And when I made that suggestion, it was because I saw the kind of values I would love to see in anyone who would in fact be a president. You know, someone who is rational, someone who is observant, someone who understood the fiduciary responsibility of being a leader. And that's what HEB is showing.
Well, and they understand the whole Texas spirit of Texans helping Texans. I saw where some people who had just moved to Texas after Hurricane Ike or Hurricane Harvey, for example, the big HEB trucks, command centers from the company show up in the storm zone, making sure that people have everything that they need. They show up with, you know, pre-prepared meals for everybody. Somebody had asked and remarked, I think it was one of the guys with CBS News had said that some folks were telling him, you know, they were asking, why can't HEB be in charge of FEMA? I would say that the way that they reflect the way Texans actually behave is the way that some of our leaders should have talked about it and maybe tapped into. I mean, it was something we talked about a little bit earlier, Arnie, when we were talking about the mask mandate in Texas, that people would have to wear a mask. And at first we had a governor who was talking about it, in the way that the people who are with the Tea Party talk about it, where it's all about freedom and liberty. And what they really mean is selfishness. When there is a hurricane in Texas, and I've seen this going back all the way, this past weekend was the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and I was thinking about the aftermath of that, and there would be these storm shelters and help centers for people that have been set up in Houston, and there are long lines. There are lines for food assistance, rental assistance, etc. The longest line in Houston the longest line is the line of volunteers, people who are asking, what can I do to help? What do y'all need me to do? And so what the governor should have done when it came to the masks is just say, I know a lot of you are asking, what can I do to help? Well, you could put on this mask, and he could put on the mask in the moment on live TV, and just say, if you will do this, then we can slow the spread of this disease. And he wouldn't have to mandate it right out of the gate. But if he saw the numbers shifting in such a way that he did need to mandate it, then he could simply say, without having ever adopted that language of, you know, freedom and liberty and the government can never make you put it on any of that, he could simply say to all of the people who have been wearing the mask and have been trying to help, he could say, for those people who didn't want to do what you're doing, for those people who aren't helping, they're going to have to pay $250 a piece if they're not doing the mask like you and I are. But as for the rest of us, keep on doing what you're doing. And he wouldn't have looked like a fool flipping completely 180, saying that the government should never be able to make you to do this. And then on the other hand, you know, flipping right around and dropping a YouTube video on, you know, one afternoon, like a new Taylor Swift album, and just saying, yes, you do have to wear the mask.
There would have been a consistency to his argument. Thank you so much, Scott Braddock. If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. He is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, and of course, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And you are very lucky to have HEB in your state. I'm in a way a little bit jealous, but we have kind of a variation on a theme called Market Basket. So
thank you so much.
All right, ciao. Take care.
Thanks,
of yourself. Arnie. All right. Stick around. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. When we come back, Stefan Schmidt.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1875. That was the day anti-black violence erupted into a two-day massacre in Clinton, Mississippi. As many as 2,500 black Republicans and their families met at Moss Hill, a former plantation destroyed during the Civil War. The day was one of festivities and political speeches ahead of the fall elections. The County Republican Party invited local Democrats to debate. The Democratic state senatorial candidate did address the crowd. The editor of a local Republican newspaper and union officer, Captain H.T. Fisher, followed him. Soon, a group of white Democrats began to heckle Fisher as he spoke. Republican politicians attempted to quell the growing tensions. Almost immediately, however, the heckling whites opened fire on the crowd. Women and children fled in all directions as black Republican forces rushed to defend themselves and their families. By the end of the day, three whites and five blacks were killed. Clinton's mayor fed off rumors of black retaliation. He called upon white paramilitary forces, the White Liners, from surrounding areas for assistance. Several hundred answered the call and filled the town's streets. Historian Melissa Janczewski-Jones notes that though heavily armed, the White Liners accompanied white locals as they rampaged door to door looking for black Republicans to murder. After 2 days, as many as 50 black Clintonians were killed by white Democrats looking to end Reconstruction and regain political control of Mississippi. A Senate committee would later conclude, quote, the riots at Clinton were part of a special purpose on the part of the Democrats to break up the meetings of Republicans and inaugurate an era of terror, not only in those communities, but throughout the state. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Mumbling something. everything that we need.
Welcome back to Part 2 of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. Every other week, we get to hang out with Stefan Schmidt. Stefan Schmidt, I think, is retired from Iowa State. He is known affectionately as Dr. Politics. He was teaching political science at Iowa State for decades. I don't know how they're going to function without him. I don't know how he'll function without them, but I want to welcome him to the program. And just to let you know, Stefan, I mean, Iowa is all over the news and not for good reasons. Let me just tell you, it's a story of disaster when it comes to dealing with COVID.
Yeah, you know, it's the aftermath of the disaster with the Iowa Democratic caucuses, which, you know, were a huge embarrassment in a state that prides itself on having the best education system, public education in the country, which it no longer does. A state that now has one of the worst, probably the worst water system in the country. Everything is polluted. The city of Des Moines cannot find enough good water in any of the rivers to deliver to 500,000 people who are the water customers, because the runoff from agriculture and the contamination of it with nitrates and stuff has made water so scarce. And now we have bad statistics where the governor's office discovered that they were just not reporting the number of COVID cases correctly. And, you know, they said, well, it's because we have old computers. Well, you know what? The numbers are not so big that you couldn't have three or four people counting every morning and reporting by counting them manually. You don't need a computer. This is not that complicated.
Simple math.
The numbers are terrible. And then on top of that, of course, and you probably want to talk about our Senator Joni Ernst, which I'm happy to do.
I want to sort of reiterate what Stefan just said. Here is the story from September 1st from CNN. Task force report shows dire warnings to Iowa, the state with the highest case rate this week. So whether they have old computers or they're counting by hand or they're doing it on their fingers, I don't know. The numbers look disastrous. But given that that's the backstory, okay, I want that there. Now let's talk about what Joni Ernst said regarding COVID-19 and the healthcare industry in her state, because she is basically suggesting that they're making stuff up.
Yes, she's blaming doctors, nurses, hospitals, and others who do healthcare, saying that they're inflating the number of people who are getting sick or dying in Iowa, and blaming it on COVID, because if you blame it on COVID, you can charge more. I'm hearing gasps from Republicans. I'm hearing gasps from even, you know, the governor, that this senator would be saying this, because it is the narrative of a right-wing conspiratorial group that has been supporting Donald Trump and that has been cooking up a lot of things like this. I mean, you know, if you undermine people's trust in their doctors and nurses and clinics and hospitals, you're essentially attacking one of the few institutions left in this country that we rely on and trust. People think that this is suicide for her, and I don't understand it, because the polls are close and they're tight, and the Democrat running against her is quite a good candidate. She's very articulate and has run a magnificent primary. And then Joni Ernst has to go essentially into the ditch like this. Why would she do that? You know, it's incomprehensible.
And I want to share what the AP said. Ernst, who is facing an unexpectedly tough re-election fight, made the comment after a man at a campaign stop in Waterloo, Iowa, said he believes the number of cases and deaths are much lower than reported. Experts, however, refute that and say the new data suggests that the toll is probably significantly higher than the official count. So Joni is responding to a story being planted by someone who's questioning her, who obviously has embraced, you know, the Trump Kool-Aid and the QAnon stuff, instead of challenging him, instead of defending her medical community, instead of actually saying, probably that's not true, let me tell you why, she embraces the lie. It's so shocking, because I watched her during the Republican or the Trump convention thinking, what the hell are you doing up there? And then thinking that was a big mistake. And then I'm looking at this, I mean, she is cratering whether she wins or loses. She is losing any sense of integrity.
Well, that's right. And you know, she was on a glide path to essentially being respected. She served in the National Guard in Iraq. She was sexually assaulted, and so she's a victim of sexual assault. She actually is one of the more bipartisan senators by certain standards. She has criticized President Trump on certain things. What happened suddenly to her there is really puzzling to me. More than anything, it's puzzling to me. And so, again, you know, Iowa in the news. And of course, as you know, my great university, I'm still doing a lot of teaching, by the way. I am retired, but emeritus professors usually are harvested back in there to help graduate students. I have some graduate students I'm supervising and so on. But our university in Ames, Iowa, and Story County, where Iowa State is the place that is seeing this massive surge in COVID. And the reason is the students are coming back and have come back. And as you might expect, they party, they misbehave. The campus has tried everything it can to be safe, to make them wear masks, to have separation, and the classrooms are very well divided, you know, so that they don't sit right on top of each other. But then they go into town and they go to parties and things, and apparently they have, and I'll be honest with you, I've been going into the grocery stores and stuff. And at one point, they were very careful. They had one entrance and one exit. They had the aisles where you had to go down the aisle this way and back the aisle the other way. And after about a month or two, no one was paying any attention to that. Not just students, because there weren't any students at the time. It was just people. And people were supposed to wear masks, but the governor of Iowa never mandated masks. So a lot of people said, well, I'm not going to wear a mask. The price that you pay for essentially being careless is that now we are in the news in such a terrible way.
As an epicenter.
And then our football program. Right?
I wanted to get to that. Let me just read the headline. Iowa State in the worst city for COVID-19 in the country. Let me repeat that opening sentence. Iowa State in the worst city for COVID-19 in the country will let 25,000 fans attend season opener. I mean, I actually had to take like some drugs after I read that headline. Like, what are they? I mean, I love people in Ames. I know people at Iowa State. You have changed my life because Ames feels like my second home.
And we love you there.
Well, I'm crying because I'm like, what the hell are they thinking?
We are a state university. We are a, you know, Big 12 university with a tremendous football program that invests tens of millions, actually probably hundreds of millions of dollars in the stadium. The alumni are asked to give to the sports programs. They're asked to give a little bit to academia, but the sports are the big thing. We're like Texas. Really, I'm sorry that Scott isn't on anymore, but we're like Texas. We love our football.
It's a tailgating,
Arnie. The tailgating at Iowa State is monumental, and people have rigs with giant roasters and trailers that they pull behind them where they do their ribs and smoke stuff. And the parking lot around the football field where the tailgating is unbelievable. I mean, it's like world class. So the athletic program is extremely powerful. And the athletic director and the coach of our football team said, we've got, you know, we'll do it safely. We'll only have half of the number of people that we normally.
Only 25,000. What could happen?
25,000, right. And the president of the university, who is very often under a lot of pressure from the athletic program, Wendy Winterstein, said, okay, let's try it. It'll be safe. We'll do the best we can. Then the county, and there is a medical doctor who is very influential, the city of Ames, which now has mandated masks, said, oh my God, you know, this is going to be another disaster. You're going to have 25,000 people coming in. They're going to tailgate somewhere. They're not going to pay attention to that. The ones who don't have tickets, there are going to be all kinds of parties. But guess what? The blowback was so much that President Winterstein said, I'm sorry, we're not going to have 25,000. So we're not going to have 25,000. She reversed herself.
So now what are you having? Are you going to have a football game that's going to be on Zoom?
In an empty stadium.
It is an empty stadium.
In an empty stadium. Yes, wow. Empty stadium. Wow. And of course, you can't win because now people are saying, oh, you know, you shouldn't have reversed yourself. Once you said that, you know, people got ready. They bought tickets because people fly in. People who have season tickets fly in from Arizona, California, everywhere. The restaurants were getting ready to deliver, you know, safe food to people. And now it's been reversed, and so everybody is furious about that. You can't win with this COVID virus.
So I just want to at least sort of reemphasize why Iowa really is sort of central castings for COVID-19. So we're talking about Ames being probably number one in the state, if not in the country. But let me tell you who number two is. Number two is Iowa City, where the University of Iowa is. They're number two on the list of the highest per capita numbers of COVID-19 positive cases per thousand. So I'm just telling you, whatever is going on, and I saw a story, there was a sick out, I believe, maybe yesterday at the University of Iowa. And I have to sort of share with you, I mentioned how I have this love affair with Ames. Well, my oldest daughter went to the University of Iowa, and she's calling me up from Shanghai going, what the hell is going on in Iowa? Literally just before the show, because she's following the news as well. It's like, this is supposed to be nice Iowa. This is highly educated Iowa. This is Iowa that has this respect for science, respect for the medical community. And she's looking at this going, don't they realize that it's not only you could survive COVID, but you might have a permanent health condition if you contract COVID. It ain't the flu.
That's right. And there is something strange that has happened because the Republicans in Iowa were at one time bipartisan in the sense that it was a purple state, that they got along with Democrats. There wasn't a war between Democrats and Republicans. And our governor has done strange things. I mean, the University of Iowa is one of the most respected medical schools in the country. It is a fantastic medical school. They have epidemiologists. They have statisticians that are experts in health statistics. What does the governor do to get the testing? She says, no, I'm not going to use the University of Iowa. I'm going to ask Ashton Kutcher, the movie star and TV star, who is from Marshalltown, Iowa. Ashton, do you know of any place or any company that we could hire that will do the testing? Ashton says, oh, yeah, I heard about a company in Utah. They've never done this before, but they're kind of trying to get into this business of testing. And you should contact them. So not only does she contact them, but she gives them a $25 million contract to do all the testing.
A no-bid contract, by the way, everyone.
A no-bid contract.
I want to remind capitalism is about competition. So yeah. Not only do they piss away on the capitalism thing because they got a no-bid contract with a company that has no history. And as you point out, instead of going to our own community, instead of going to our own universities, she's reaching out to Utah. That's not a problem. You could reach out to Uganda, as far as I'm concerned. But if there's no history there, then what kind of reliance do you have that they're going to provide you with the kind of quality testing you're going to need?
Well, my own opinion is, I think we should contact Vladimir Putin because he has a vaccine that he gave to his daughter. And maybe we can get the Putin vaccine, you know, real quickly and see how that works out. There is something in the air or the water that is making the United States an incomprehensible country in some ways. People in other countries are looking at the United States and saying, what's going on? You were the world leader in so many different things. And now the scientific community in the United States is under attack. You neglected to follow a rigorous procedure in order to contain the virus, not to kill it because we don't have a way to do that, but to slow it down and make sure not so many people get infected. And all over the place, there is craziness going on. So I don't know. Maybe it's the alignment of the planets.
Let me just point something out, because Donald Trump has announced that starting, I believe, even in October, he's telling states and communities to be ready for the vaccines.
Right.
So he's taking this incredible leadership step. Get ready, be prepared. Here's what you need to do. He's offering them guidance on a vaccine that nobody even knows what he's talking about. But isn't it interesting, when it came to testing, he punted.
Right.
So he even told us not to test. Why bother testing? We don't even need to know the numbers. Sure,
Well, if we test, we're going to have higher numbers of COVID infections. So if we stop testing, the numbers will be a lot lower.
I mean, again, Donald Trump is the illness. Donald Trump is the disease. Donald Trump has, in fact, infected the water and the air and the dialogue and the education and the TV. He's a rabid infection is what he is. And unfortunately, we're finding out that we're more vulnerable to him than we are even to COVID-19, which is what makes it so scary. But there was a story that came out at Slate this morning at 7:15. Let me read you the headline. Trump instructs the Department of Justice to classify Democratic cities as anarchist jurisdictions to help him win re-election. Anarchist jurisdictions? What does this mean? And what does this imply that he can do? Oh my God, you're the political science, you know, PhD in the family. What the hell is this about?
I've never heard of anarchist jurisdictions. And it may be something new that has suddenly come along. And there's certainly a lot of disruption. And I remember the 1960s very well because I was a college student and then I was a graduate student in New York. And we had a lot of anarchist jurisdictions in the 1960s over the Vietnam War. They were never treated as sort of enemy territory. They were places where there was a lot of heartfelt anger about a war that even today now we realize was unnecessary. It was a war we couldn't win. We weren't winning. The police shootings that we see, the cases where the police are putting hoods over people and then the person dies because they can't breathe and they die. We just discovered one of those this morning. Should be a warning sign to us that, you know, we need to calm down. We need to get reorganized and refocus and become more realistic because, you know, you can't crush this disruption. It is in part genuine. Of course, there are bad elements, both from the left and the right, that are commingling with the protests. And those elements are dangerous.
Let me just say something. But here's the difference between the left and the right. And that is that the right has someone in the White House that is encouraging them. That the right has someone in the White House that is spreading their lies. He's aiding and abetting whatever they're trying to do. On the left, you've got everyone. You've got Bernie, you've got Biden, people are trying to tap it down. But on the right, they're throwing more gasoline on the flames. Let me just read you about that idea of an anarchist jurisdiction that you and I have never heard of. I just want people to hear this. This is a case of first impression. President Donald Trump on Wednesday signed a memo threatening to withhold federal funding from Democratic-run cities the White House deems anarchist jurisdictions because of their handling of ongoing civil unrest that continues to ripple around the country. In this five-page presidential memo entitled Memoranda on Reviewing Funding to State and Local Government Recipients that are permitting anarchy, violence, and destruction in American cities is more of a, quote, political document than a policy one designed to sow division.
Well, that's certainly a rational conclusion. On the other hand, let me say that I've talked to some of my friends or acquaintances who are, you know, they may be sort of Democrats, but they're in the middle somewhere. And some of them are independents. They never know who to vote for. And they're actually quite upset and disturbed by what's going on, for example, with the protesters going in, protesting, and then setting on fire buildings where the mayors of these cities are living. I mean, there's an article this morning, the mayors in cities like Portland and Seattle and other places, they're having to move out of their apartments and houses because the protesters are becoming really violent. And those protesters are not the right wing, you know, that, you know, we talk about. Those are genuine Black Lives Matter and other protesters. And setting police stations on fire, I'm sorry, but, you know, probably a lot of Americans, if you asked them, would say, no, that's not part of protesting. There is something there that if it continues until November 3rd, is going to make it more difficult, I think, for the Democrats to win elections because people are worried about it.
All right, but let's also remember that we don't know who's setting the fires. Remember one of the scenes where you saw some guy taking his umbrella and breaking all the windows or a brick? And it turned out he wasn't a Black Lives Matter protester. He was the other side. Look at the guy who's now killed two protesters and wounded a third. It was a young 17-year-old from Illinois that came up basically to sort of to protect the businesses. And you know what's really interesting to me is how they talk about the young 17-year-old, that he was confused. He didn't really understand what was he doing. Did he appreciate the kind of violence that he was being, you know, asked to contribute to? And I'm thinking, really? When it's a young Black guy that robs a 7-Eleven at age 16, no one says, oh, the poor young 16-year-old Black guy. I mean, I just want everyone to know, when it's white and violent, we give it a pass.
Yeah.
When it's Black and violent, then it becomes all Blacks. This is what makes me so crazy, is that everything is color-coded. And we see the fact that they shoot a Black man, and they see people basically respond, and then everyone assumes that all the chaos and all the violence is because of African-Americans' Black Lives Matter, when in fact what we found out is that people that have died at the hands of the other side.
It requires us to, as Dr. Brix says, be more granular, which means we have to look at the actual details. And I can tell you, in Iowa, we're having Black Lives Matter protests, and they are genuinely led by Black Lives Matter, now Black Liberation Movement. They've changed their name. The leader of that, who is self-appointed, has been arrested 4 times now of committing all kinds of things. And in Iowa City, you know that Iowa City was once the capital of Iowa. And there is a beautiful building there that was the state house of Iowa. And a few years ago, they began a $20 million project to restore it to its original beautiful self. Right. Well, the Black Lives protesters have completely defaced the building. They've broken things. They've set fires and spray painted it. And they're not the anarchists. They're not the Antifas or anything. And I think that undermines the broad public support that exists in this country, that we feel that the police need to have different ways of dealing with confrontations, that we have to have a much more complex and diverse way of dealing with mental illness, with, you know, spousal abuse and domestic abuse and other things. And the protesters, even in a little state like Iowa, where there are, you know, a tiny percent of African Americans, are pushing in a direction, basically defunding the police and getting rid of the police, that is causing a backlash in the broader community. And that doesn't build coalitions. That does not.
I want to just say something. What's so interesting to me is that when Donald Trump encourages white supremacists, there is no accusation of a backlash. When Black Lives Matter are accused of, you know, taking it too far because their people have been killed by police, then everyone says, look at the backlash. So again, even when we talk about a backlash, the backlash exists when you're Black. The backlash does not exist when you're a white supremacist. And that to me is what's so offensive. But before we let you go, because I only have 2 minutes left, you know, he's rolling out this idea of a vaccine coming out right before the election, which to me is just ridiculous. If you already are afraid of not trusting this president, not trusting the CDC, not trusting the scientists that are rolling out behind Donald Trump, the other story that I saw that was just so fascinating was that he is not willing to work with the rest of the world on finding a vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
And what is so tragic about that is that what happens if we have a flawed, failed vaccine and China or Korea or Japan come up with one that's successful? Right. The last place they will send the vaccine to is us.
It's an incredibly short-sighted, unfair, and counterproductive sort of move on his part. I would say that in Iowa, there is a backlash because against what's going on, because the two Democrats who hold House seats, Abby Finkenstein and Axne, are ahead in the polls, ahead of the Republicans. So that's, I think, a sign that a lot of people are saying, you know, we really are disturbed by what's going on in Washington. And, you know, we think that these sort of middle of the road members of Congress that we elected the last time around are doing a pretty good job. So I think what is happening is, I mean, people are afraid of Trump and Pence people. They're afraid of them. They're not going to publicly say what they think. And I think that there may be a lot more backlash than is publicly recognized, because there may be, people are saying there's a silent majority that's going to vote for Trump. I've been saying maybe there's a silent majority that's going to vote for Biden.
And on that note, there's no silent majority here, because it's the Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And if it's every other Friday, it must be Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State. Thank you so much for joining us, Stefan.
Wonderful show. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, everyone. See you on Monday for our Rethinking Week. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Have a good, safe weekend. Ciao. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back. Let's go way on, way back when. I didn't even know you. You couldn't have been too much more than 10.